Good evening. My name is Rachel Black Elk, and I am a diversity retention coordinator for Native students here at PCC, and I'm also the Native Nations Club coordinator. And so we'd like to introduce you to Winona LaDuke, and this is Earth Week's first event. We have events coming in later this week. But I would like to introduce this woman who has countless accomplishments, has won many awards for her public service and social justice with the indigenous culture. And she is not only well known through her awards, but as a two-time vice presidential nominee with the Green Party and Ralph Nader. She was also nominated by Time in 1994 as one of America's 50 most influential people under 40 years old. So she has many more accomplishments, but I would like to honor her as a mother, since we are in Earth Week and the Mother Earth is what we are celebrating. Maxim Gorky once stated, "Only mothers can think of the future because they give birth to it in their children." So for a mother of three, being an activist and environmentalist, I would like to honor her for that work as well. Thank you, and welcome Winona LaDuke.
Hi, can you hear me okay? Okay, thank you. I'm sorry I was a little late, but thank you all for waiting for me and not leaving. Anin nindoe maganaduk, ngagwegiti bongas, vide sikwe dugo makwa ndodeam, kawa babani kag, ishkani gining indunjiba miigwich. That's Ojibwe, which I guess you gathered, and I'm greeting you and thanking you very much for the honor of being here today. I was thinking about what I wanted to talk with you about, so I wrote this on the plane, and I just put this together. So a little bit this first time, all right? Just so we have an understanding on that. But I'm going to talk about the idea of economics for the seventh generation. And in saying that, hold on. I don't know if any of you know this, but I'm actually an economist by training. Does anybody know that? Something I just started admitting publicly, because they always have like a really bad rap, you know what I mean? And then I realized that I actually think about a lot of things, and I want to talk about them. And I was just hanging out at the couple of big economics conferences over the past couple years, and it was very interesting to realize that a lot of the thinking that I had as the person that I am, having done the work I do, in relationship to the economy is increasingly not only resonating, but it's reflected in other people's thinking. So let me start by saying that there are some teachings that I think outline a lot of that, where we are and where it is that we should be going. And many of you know this, but let me just start with saying that two teachings that I think frame a lot of the reference that I have as to where we need to deliberate is first the Iroquois Confederacy teaching, which says in each deliberation we should consider the impact upon the seventh generation from now. Intergenerational thinking, or simply put in the words of my friend Mike Wiggins, the tribal chairman of the Bad River Reservation, he says, sometimes it seems like people don't feel like hanging around another 1,000 years. You know, I mean, we are a society in America that is quite prone to quarterly profits thinking, term limits or not, you know, election year thinking, and not intergenerational responsibility. A second concept is that which is held in our Anishinaabe prophecies. In our teachings as Anishinaabe people, we are told that that these prophets came to us a long time ago, and you should listen to them if they come your way. And when they came, they instructed us. They said what was going to happen. And they said, we'd do pretty good. This is a summation, you know, a summation that they said we'd do pretty good, and then we'd end up kind of botching some things up. And I always say that because no society has a monopoly on botching things up. We do that because we're human. It's a question if you've got the humility and the commitment to fix it. But that is what humans do. And then they talked about how some people would come and some would be good and some would be bad. And that's true. Some of the people who came to this country were great people and some of them were rotten. You know, and that's just the reality of the situation. They talked about how a lot of our people would disappear. And our people did not have a word for smallpox, but that's what that must have been, you know. Depopulation, 90% of the people gone, you know. talked about how some of our things would disappear, and I don't think anybody had a word for anthropologists. That's probably what they're talking about. And they hauled off all our stuff, you know, put it in museums and hauled off our people too, yeah? And, you know, conceptually out of someone's framework, if you really think about it, you know, if your prophets are telling you this and that these things happen, yeah? Then they talked about how a lot of our people would be asleep, and I think they're talking about the boarding school or the residential school era, where we were, you know, forced into this you know, really this state. And then they talked about how these new people would be born, called the Ashki Anishinaabeg. That's how they refer to them, the Ashki Anishinaabeg, the new people. And they said that those people would then be faced with two paths, two mikana. One path, they said, would be well-worn but scorched. The other path would be not well-worn, it would be green. And it would be our choice as Anishinaabeg upon which path to embark. And I think that that is very much where we are in America, as well as Anishinaabe people. There's two paths. One's well-scorched, and one is green. And then it's a question of where we are going. This art, I actually have this painting. It's on my wall. This is really reflects a lot of the work that we're doing in my community. It talks about the idea of what it is of value that is in your teachings, your knowledge, and then sharing that with a broader knowledge that, and teachings that you can get and where you're going. This old guy from my community named Nagani Benes, or Leading Bird, is one of our chiefs. And he's sitting there drinking some coffee. I assume it's fair trade organic. And out his back window is those wind turbines, you know. But we have this term, you know, I'm a student of Ojibwe or Anishinaabe Mohan, and my teacher, he was very fond of me. He said, you know, he said to me, Jimisa Wabindaming, Winona, Jimisa Wabindaming. I said, what's that mean? He says, it's what you do. He says, positive window shopping for your future. The idea is where we're going, you know, how we're going to decide it and get there. So I'm going to do some, you know, analysis on that. How we are going to get there, I'm not sure. You know, that is a lot of your hearts and minds. I do have a few ideas on that. But part of that process is that we have to deconstruct our own colonization and our, as in the words of Bob Marley, our mental slavery, liberate our minds from mental slavery. And I say that with great reverence, and I like to always show this piece of art, which is art from my community. It's obviously an acrylic painting. I don't know if that's obvious to you, but it originates in our pictographs, and that is then followed by our Madewan drawings, which are very, very old. They're on the side of the cliffs on the lakes in the north area where I live, in Anishinaabe Aking. And then they appear, you know, in different drawings, and this school of art was brought back in the early 70s. But within this art, you see some things that I think are of great significance in this art form. You see inside the beings, so you see their spiritual nature inside the beings and the life that is within them, which is a set of teachings about not only that the world is animate, but also that we ourselves, that all things have spirit, have standing. And then you see these lines that connect the beings, and those are called spirit lines. And that is this teaching that I think is also a tenet of sustainability. Like the teaching that most of the world is animate, and like the seventh generation teaching. And that teaching is that we are all related. And in our language, we say in Dinoe Maganaduk, which means we are all related. But I say that because in that you see that, you know, we are all related. We're 99.9% the same, which I know really bummed out the white supremacists when they first figured that out, right? You know, but in addition to that, we are related to the rest of creation, and we are not separate. In fact, we're pretty highly dependent on them. And so the teaching about not being anthropocentric is probably a good idea. So when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, if you wanted to study the art from Europe, you went to the fine arts department. If you wanted to study the art from Native America, you went to anthropology. And I say that because that's indicative of our mindset that any of us with a Western education has. Evaluation of things from Europe and from America as being superior knowledge and fine. And outside of that, not being viewed at the same validity. So in saying that, you know, I think that it is part of the challenge. America is not the smartest country in the world. I say duh because people text me duh a lot. The smartest country in the world. That perhaps part of our challenge is how we rethink our own colonization. And what it is to be an American. and the mythology of being an American. You know, in part, one of the best examples is the idea of the frontier, the West. It is a state of mind, the transience that is America, that most people do not live where their parents live or their grandparents live, disconnects us from responsibility to place and understanding and knowledge, and also creates this myth that there is some greener pasture someplace else, and we can always keep moving. That it becomes a kind of psychosis if you're trying to create a sustainable society, the idea that you can keep moving. And, you know, as many, you know, Native people will tell you, or in my recent travels, I was privileged to show you some slides. I was in Hawaii, and they said, we don't have an exit plan. You know, no exit plan, no exit strategy. Very important conceptual framework for staying. Also possible to understand that the Holy Land is here. It's not someplace else. It is Omaha King, Celilo Falls, the Holy Land. This is the Holy Land here. So let me talk a little bit about our situation. I'm not going to give you a lecture on this. So I'm going to go give you a little bit more than you might have had. This is our reality. We've scorched pretty well. We have been busy raising CO2. And since March 1st, I was reading this guy. Anyway, 13,393 daily records for heat sent worldwide since March 1st. Not bad. Could be a freak. Could be freak, right? Unfortunately, it is not a freak because there is 129,404 weather records set this last year, right, around the world. It is changing. It's getting weird. And we have no idea what's going to happen. I actually almost missed my... I could not get here last night because there was a massive storm in Minneapolis. Violent. Could not... Every plane was grounded. Yeah. So it is projected that by the year 2020, we will be spending 20% of world GDP on climate change-related disasters. Not sure whose stock portfolio that one's in. Yeah. That is what the scorched earth looks like. This is what the temperatures look like. I'm sure you've seen some of these. Yeah? I guess those are going up, yeah? This is the anomalies. Oops, this is blank. This is the Greenland ice mass, obviously. That appears to be going down. Right? This is what it looks like in Kivalina, an Alaskan Native village. This is what it looks like on the ground, let alone if you are in the South Pacific. I was down there last year, and, you know, Tuvalu, the country, is looking for a new country, right? A lot of other places. But by and large, our strategy is, since they are far away and we do not see them, we do not address that. CO2, seawater, this is what acidification looks like, a direct consequence. Kind of an interest to the people in the Pacific Northwest, right? This is what we don't see. This is all came from this climate change conference I was just at. The second issue that we are facing is the failing of the U.S. economy. Since, okay, the problem of peak oil, this is actually not quite the most accurate. We just consume too much, but there's also not a lot more out there. It turns out 67% of the oil that remains out there that is in known sources, not including like the polar ice caps, is in, quote, unfree countries. Unfree countries. Maybe our friends, maybe not. A little dodgy, right? In other words, there's oil out there, but there's only so many wars we can likely engage in to get the rest of that oil. The remaining oil is up in the polar ice caps at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, where the Deepwater Horizon found it, right? Or up in the tar sands of Alberta. So we end up with the reality that we are facing, that since 1975, U.S. oil imports have cost us $3 trillion. Single largest transfer of wealth in the history of the world. So how does that pan out with that over the future, right? probably going to be more expensive. Yeah. Huge implications for all of us, including our communities. And then there was the added, what is the added brilliant idea that I just saw? What are they trying to ship to China? Coal, right? To open more markets for American coal, which, you know, might reduce the debt to China, but probably will not reduce CO2 emissions, from what I can gather. I'm not really totally on this, but I'm pretty sure that mining more coal is not going to help the situation, but may address some of the economics. So the economics is not looking good. And then there's the issue of food security. So I have been reading two books. I'm going to reference them, which is really funny. Anybody who knows me knows that I'm not a fan of British Empire. Does that make sense? But on the plane, I read On the Future of Food, His Royal Highness Prince Charles. Isn't that interesting? Did you guys know that he was actually kind of smart? He has kind of a bad rap. I realize that. But I actually got schooled by this guy. 2004, I was at the Terra Madre, being the Slow Food International Gathering in Italy. The final day of the Slow Food Gathering, having just really been quite smitten and learning quite a bit about food movements worldwide. There's five of us giving the final speeches. I give the third speech. I sit down, and then all this stuff goes on. There's all this security, and all of a sudden I look up and His Royal Highness comes in to give the fourth speech. I was like, wow, check that out. There's Prince Charles, right? So you know what the guy says? He says a lot more radical than what is in this book, but he says, you know, the next billion people going to be born in the world are going to be born in the slums of Calcutta, in the slums of Rio, in the slums of Mexico City. They're going to be born in war-torn countries. They're going to be refugees, and they're going to be hungry. And so who's going to take care of those chickens when they come home to roost? That's what he said. And I said, that guy's kind of radical. But then I realized he's the prince. He can say whatever he wants to, and no one's going to get his job, right? It was an interesting moment, though, when I realized that he had these thoughts. So this very small book, The Future of Food, I'm sure you can find it on the internet. This is what he tells you. Very interesting. There's 1 billion obese people in the world. Check that out. So there's about 6 million, right? 6 billion, right? People in the world. 1 billion people are obese, 1 billion people are starving, and 1 billion people are malnourished. So half of the world is suffering from some kind of food-related challenge, right? And a lot of it has to do with what we grow, how we grow it, and how it's distributed, right? So the examples he gives are that 40% of the food grown in the third world never makes it. It's spoiled or eaten by pests or whatever, mice, yeah? The other side of it is what happens in America? 40% of our food, what happens to that? Wastes, right? Baffling. Baffling, this kind of like where we are at in our heads and where we are at in the inefficiencies of our economy, right? Let alone how much it costs to grow the food that we just tossed. They say that the average American basically consumes 1 gallon of diesel a day in food. Interesting. Average meal travels 1,456 miles from farmer to table. Yeah? Plus the amount of petrochemicals slathered on it from point of origin to packaging, let alone transportation, right? All the stuff that ends up down in the Gulf of Mexico. So you have a food system that is entirely related to gas. Yeah. Unsustainable, the less oil you have. This is not the economy that is going to last us for the next 1,000 years. Add to that the price tag for that economy. The price tag for obesity in the United States, $168 billion a year. Interesting, huh? So someone's making money on that, apparently, right? But is that actually the way what we want to count in our GDP? Is that what we want to count in our economy? This is, you know, what is beginning to happen to the seeds in our country. Sobering. By 1995, 75% of all seed companies were owned by a few corporations. But now, they started increasing. Monsanto, Bayer, DuPont, Syngenta, Novartis, 75% of all seeds are owned by those corporations. Monsanto itself owns 84 seed companies, right? The concentration has a huge effect on the access to seeds, not only control over the food supply. My friend Carolyn Chartrand is a Métis woman from Manitoba, northern Manitoba. She said, in the early 1800s, the Métis grew some 120 distinct seed varieties near Winnipeg. Of those, we found 20 so far. We found them through the Canadian Seed Bank, Seeds of Diversity Canada, Canadian Seed Exchange. I really miss my seeds. I don't get to grow them out. The Canadian seed story is pretty sobering. 3/4 of all seeds that existed before the 20th century are extinct. And out of the remaining quarter, only 10% are commercially available in Canada from seed companies. Over 64% of the commercially held seeds are offered by only one company, which means if they decide not to list them, they're gone. So as we look at how we are going to survive, the concentration, the shrinking of agrobiodiversity is increasingly going to affect our ability to continue. Then there is this challenge. My reservation, this is a study we did, snapshot of pretty much any rural community that I can figure. We have every statistic you don't want to have in my community. We are the poorest county in the state of Minnesota. There you go. We have a new cluster of Hep C. CDC just pointed out to us, largely related to heroin, right? We have 50% unemployment on my reservation. We have the highest rates of incarceration. Just sounding, and 1/3 of our people have diabetes. There you go. Sounding like the place you'd like to live, right? That's what we're looking at, and so we studied to figure out what was going on with our food system. And what we found was that we spend we surveyed households, and we found that we spend about $8 million a year on food, of which we spend $7 million off my reservation at Walmart and at Food Service of America buying food, right? The $1 million we spend on reservation is spent at convenience stores buying junk food. That's a snapshot of an American rural economy, a snapshot of a poor economy. So the strategy that's generally forwarded and bantered about by politicians and economists, whether they are tribal planners or whoever, is always, let us get more jobs. Let's make more money into our community. Let's get more jobs, right? And what we know in my community is that this represents 1/4 of my economy. The other 1/4 is energy, which we spend entirely off-reservation importing oil, right? So between those two, you have a leak that represents 50% of your economy. Y'all follow me on this pretty well? And so you can keep pumping money in, but it's going to leak out. And this is pretty much a snapshot of any place you go in this country. So the, you know, pretending that it's an argument between jobs and the environment, or pretending that your only answer is to create more jobs, is actually an entirely false debate if you've got a leak that represents half of your economy. Yeah? This is the beginning of the answer. This is seeds from the Mandans, 1919, you can see the catalog. This is agrobiodiversity in corn. 8,000 varieties of corn developed in the Americas. No small feat. Our community is the northernmost corn growers in the world. We pushed corn 100 miles north of Winnipeg. Those are some adaptable varieties. The biologists came out to look at us, and they, to look at these guys, I don't know what you call those guys, What do you call those guys that come and look at your corn varieties in 1812? ETO? Etymologists? Thank you. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so these guys come out and look at us, and they say, look at this corn. And they're fascinated by the fact that it's, this is what he says, it's already a yard high, it's about full height, to which the maize grows in the upper Missouri. It grows only a yard high, right? And this is connected to the quickness of its growth, and it matures. It's a wonderful instance, the power given to some plants to accommodate themselves to climate. This plant is certainly the same species of Zea that is cultivated in the tropics, where it usually requires 4 months to ripen and rises to the height of 12 feet. Here, 10 weeks is sufficient with much less degree of heat. Why I'm showing you this, and I'm going to show you a little bit more later, is that those varieties are what we consider to be climate change resilient varieties and absolutely critical to where it is we're going to be going. Because what you probably don't want is a 12-foot high corn in the northern plains in the middle of a wind sear. This is adaptation of taro in the South Pacific. After you get enough tsunamis or king waves that run over your island, you adapt your taro, wetland taro, to grow behind these I think that's coconut shells on the edge. Is that so that looks like, yeah? So this is what our communities are doing to begin to adapt food security in the time of climate change. This is my community's projects. Those of you who know a little bit about me, my father, he passed away in 1992, but he used to tell me, Winona, you're a really smart woman. I'm actually a really smart young woman, but I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. That's what he used to tell me. So it took me to like the mid-90s to begin growing corn. So I was not as smart as he thought, apparently. But I'm not a bad corn grower these days. And I spend a lot of time talking about corn, as you've probably already gathered. So these are two varieties are mine. And this is our plan. Bear Island Flint, Jonesy Miller, grows this high. I got this much seed from a seed guy from Iowa State, and I have fields of it now. It's my most resilient corn. It's drought-resistant, frost-resistant, and grows pretty much in anything. Grows really well. I never had a crop failure so far. And it's a flint corn, meaning you make hominy or pasoli out of it. Does that make, you know what I'm saying? And interestingly enough, last Monday, I was giving a lecture at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. And Dr. Bob Lawrence, one of the heads there, he stopped me, you know, after the lecture. He said, Winona, do you know any stories about why the native people used to why native people make pasoli and why they make hominy with corn? Or how they started using ashes or lime? I said, no, I have no idea. He said, well, this is what happens, and he told me this story about this disease called pellagra. Have any of you ever heard of the pellagra epidemic? Let me see how many of you. Pellagra epidemic. I thought it was like related to like Viagra, you know, Viagra, or like Pilates, or you know what I'm saying? It's like this is not a word that I had ever heard before, pellagra. But anyway, in 1905 to about 1917, there was an epidemic in the United States. It's kind of similar to like the AIDS epidemic, in that it happened to people that people didn't really care about. And they were orphans, and it happened in orphanages, prisons, and insane asylums, essentially, poor houses in the southeast. And they started dying from it, and 27,000 people died. At which point they started studying it, and they tried to make it an infectious disease, because having an infectious disease in a poor community is better than having malnutrition. And they tried to, you know, do that for a long time. They wasted a lot of time on it. Turns out these people were all being fed cornmeal and cornbread. And what had happened is that they had mechanized the corn processing process from stone ground cornmeal to a new set of technology to take out the germ, degerminated cornmeal. Is this sounding familiar to you? You've seen this, right? And if you degerminate it, it lasts longer and you can store it for a long time so you can keep your budget for an orphanage at $700 a year or $700 a month, right? Cheap. So that's what they were doing. In that process, they took out all the vitamins, which we kind of knew. But it turns out that hominy or pozole, that the lime or the alkali bioactivates all the B vitamins and dramatically increases the nutritional value of these varieties of corn. Is that interesting? And somehow we knew that. Anyway, I just learned that on Monday, but I thought that was... So this is our corn. We grow that. This is Pink Lady. It's actually a Seneca variety, and it's magenta-colored flower corn. And then this Pawnee Eagle corn, I like to tell this story. I'm a big fan of the Pawnees, but those... do you remember the slide earlier where I showed you the corn and the big lodges, the earth lodges on top of the cliffs? Pawnee houses, Mandan houses. These guys, they split off from the Arikaras, they head south, they go to Nebraska, and they're living down there in Nebraska. And with them, in their cosmogenealogy, they brought their corn with them because in their teachings, their women descended from the corn itself. And so their corn, they have about 7-8 varieties or maybe more that are their most sacred corn. They live in Nebraska and they grow their corn. They live pretty well. Come around the 1840s, 1850s, the settlers move into Nebraska, Kearney, Nebraska area. And the Pawnee and the settlers got along really well. And then, they said the Pawnees were kind of like AAA. That's how they described them to me. Like if your wagon wheel broke down, the settlers would go see the Pawnees. Or if your horse was lame, they'd go see the Pawnees. You know, they had this relationship worked out that was really good, you know, between the settlers and the Pawnees. And so they're getting along pretty well, and then the federal government came in and messed it all up, forced them to remove to Oklahoma, made them walk. I mean, you know, so they all walked to Oklahoma, and many of them perished. Three separate removals. And they moved to Oklahoma, and they despaired the loss of their people and the loss of their land. And then they despaired because their crops would not grow. And so they lost their most important and most sacred foods. And I don't know how to express that to you, but I just need you to hear that that's what they did. That's how they described it to me. And so between the 1880s, 1890s, and the late 1990s, their seeds dwindled in number until they were very desperate and very sad. And then one day, this woman named Ronnie O'Brien at the Gateway Museum in Kearney, Nebraska, called the Pawnee tribal offices and asked if they would help her because she wanted to grow a traditional Pawnee garden. And they sent her to find Deb Echo Hawk, who's the Pawnee seed keeper. And she's the one who gave me that, said I could tell her story. And she asked Deb if she could grow their seeds. And Deb did not know what to say. She went and she talked to the elders because the elders were in charge of the seeds. And they deliberated long. And they decided that they could not grow their seeds and maybe their seeds would grow in their homeland. And so they sent the seeds back to Nebraska. And the seeds were planted and they flourished. All of their varieties flourished. And so what Deb said was that the seeds remembered the land they came from. And so the descendants of the settlers grow the seeds of the Pawnees. And 2 years ago, the Pawnees, the settlers had welcome home days for the Pawnees. And 8,000 Nebraska settlers came out and welcomed 150 Pawnees home who came up on a Greyhound bus or came up on a chartered bus. And so I tell you that story because it is corn does not grow on its own. It is a covenant with humans. It is a covenant with humans that is obviously, in my feelings, violated by Monsanto. But in this story, see that corn is also, it is not just a food, but it is also a way of redemption and a way to make things right. And so this is Pawnee Eagle Corn. And you can see why they call it that. This is Frank. Frank, the USDA guy, with his corn. Do you see how short it is? That's how tall our corn grows. And so do you understand why I'm saying that in a big wind, this is the corn you want? It's not fancy huge. It's short and to the point. Right? I just found this when I was digging through my slides, and there's Frank. He's a corn guy. So that is how my community is working to address the issues of loss of seeds and food security. This is how my community is working to address the issues of renewable energy. This is a solar installation that's actually at my house on a lake in the middle of White Earth Reservation. 2 kilowatts installed by our local people in my house that is almost entirely salvaged materials. This is our wind project. This is community-scaled wind. And this is a 75-kilowatt Lowland turbine. That's my grandson, Geewaden Buckinaga, at the front. I always point out to everybody that he is well outside of the yellow tape. I just have to point that out in case you thought that I was a really bad granny. And then I want to say it's a Lowland turbine, which is important. And I'm trying to find my little thing on Lowland here. Lowland comes from an island called Lowland in Denmark. And those guys produce 250% more energy than they can use in their island. And they are... The thing about them that is also very cool is that they, almost every wind turbine that is on the market today, Vestas, NEG, Lowlands, I think Nortanks, I believe they all originated on this island in Denmark. They came from Denmark. There's a few things to consider in that. First of all, why are we so far behind? That might be one thing that one would consider, right? And I think that most of us would know the answer to that. That would be because of Exxon and BPA and PG&E having an interest in the status quo. Is that a fair enough and simple assessment? But what to learn from these guys is that this nacelle, that's the head, the turbine, and others were made... not by MIT engineers, but essentially by blacksmiths and some engineers. It is what I call appropriate technology and appropriately scaled technology, in the case that you can fix it in your community. Now, you guys have hung out with me for 45 minutes or so you may gather that I'm a pretty stubborn woman. I got this turbine out of Tehachapi Pass in California. It was running. It had been running for 20 years. I took it. I had some engineers and wind guys go over it and remanufacture and rebuild all of it. And the guy who's putting it up is a veteran. Those who know much about the Indian community might know that we have the highest rate of enlistment and the highest rate of living veterans of any community in the country. And it turns out that the skills that you learn in the military, some of them are easily transferable to a green economy. Denmark, the second book that I was reading on the plane, I'm going to recommend to you by another really smart guy, Reinventing Fire, Amory Lovins. He's got to be one of the smartest guys on the planet. I did get through this book, but I did not get through this book. I'm working on this book. Consider Denmark. A Danish home built in 2008 uses half the energy per unit of floor space of one built before 1977. The Danish economy grew by two-thirds during 1980 to 2009, while energy consumption returned to its 1980 level and carbon emissions fell 21%. All new power plants, too, are either renewable or generate both electricity and heat. Of all Danish electricity, 53% is co-generated and 30% is renewable. The average Dane releases 52% less carbon than the average Americans. Yet Danes have an excellent quality of life and the most reliable electricity in Europe with some of the lowest power prices. Interesting, huh? That's what visionary public policy will do for you. I say that because there's a lot of people who say that it cannot be done. And I think it's important to both challenge what is a lie and illustrate what is true. So this is our turbine. That other thing I want to point out to you is that that's a tubular tower as opposed to a latticework tower. Two reasons I did that. One, much less lightning strikes. Two, no bird landings. You understand what I'm saying on this? They don't build a nest on that. They build a nest on a latticework tower. This is our turbine up. My theory is essentially if we could do it, anybody could do it. That would be my theory. I already mentioned to you my lack of a lot of access to resources or privilege in my community. There's an incredible amount of intellectual capital just in this audience, you know. So I consider that and where it is we are going. This is the bigger picture of it, which some of you have already seen. The implications for, turns out that reservations are the windiest place in the country. Go figure. If any of you try going to any of those communities in South Dakota, class 7 wind. The question is how to have the intellectual, financial, and technical capital to build it, and how to get it onto a grid that is choked with coal. That's a political will question. It's not so much a technical question. The only additional technical question would be building a smart grid where you can upload distributive energy and not just go from centralized power plant to city, which is what Denmark has, right? So how do we move from here to there? That's kind of the broad set of questions. First, we address our reality. I always think of America as having a lot of psychological challenges as a society. One would be the inability to say we're wrong. It's like a collective psychosis, frankly. We don't say we're sorry. Did anybody ever notice this? We don't really say we're sorry very well, and we pretty much don't say we're wrong as a country. We give a lot of reasons why we're entitled to things. So that's kind of a broader issue. You know, I think about it often. I mean, the United States has trouble apologizing for, you know, could not apologize for the Wounded Knee Massacre, expressed regrets for that one. Recently, there was an apology, I think, about 2 years ago to Native Americans, but President Obama gave the apology and no one actually heard it. It's kind of like when the 5-year-old kicks his sister and you say, did you apologize? And they go in the corner and apologize, but nobody hears them, right? You actually have to mean it. And you actually have to say, you know, we've made some errors and we're going to do this. Second, having the courage to move towards a green path. That is this, how you, you know, and I the best economic arguments are made by individuals like Amory Levins. But the economics of living in an inefficient economy, because that's how business as usual is undertaken, is not justifiable if it requires more planets upon which to live. And that's essentially the dilemma we face. We need about 5 more planets if we're going to keep this guy up, right? And I'm pretty sure they don't exist. So if you're going to figure out how to live for the next 200 years, you probably have to figure out how to not waste 40% of your food And between point of origin and point of final consumption, waste 57% of your energy. That's what happens when you have 30-year-old coal-fired power plants, aging transmission lines, and inefficient systems throughout your buildings, let alone your materials production system, right? So you have the courage. So what does it look like? You look at basic counterintuitive solutions, counterintuitive to what we have been told. We have been told in every economics class that the economies of scale is the answer. Big production, big farms with lots of animals on them, right? There is no counting for the garbage and pollution that is created. That's what we count for, right? In our high levels of health issues, right? Our diabetes or the fact that we can't breathe. So you look at democratizing power production, creating resilience. The premise is simple. Indigenous concepts of Ndinawe Maganatuk, we are all related. Assume at their essence that you will have respect and equity between people. That is what fair trade is about, but also interspecies equity. That is an assumption that is essential in a sustainable economy. That a fish or a wolf has some rights. And we have some responsibility. Instead of having a linear-based economy, which is what we have in America, where you take natural resources and you add capital and stuff to them and you make stuff and then you pretty much throw it away, right? Or you pretend that you recycle it, which is an incredibly inefficient system, yeah? You come up with a cyclical economy, which is you mimic nature. So a couple of examples of what's wrong and then a couple of examples of what's right. What's wrong is one of our single largest industries in this country is waste management, right? That's a linear economy, right? Another example of a linear economy is a social production of waste. That is prisons. That's a linear economy. Social production of waste. In this country, on a worldwide scale, there's 9 million prisoners. 2.1 million of them live in the U.S. Highest rate of incarceration and growing rates of incarceration, right? Prison industrial complex. What does a cyclical economy look like? I'll give you a really great example. I had the privilege of going to Vanuatu this last year. Anybody have any idea where Vanuatu is? It's an island in the middle of the Pacific in Melanesia, right? I'm highly privileged. I sit on a foundation board. We go to Vanuatu. I was so excited to go to Vanuatu because for like 8 years in a row, they won the happiest country in the world award, right? So I wanted to see what the happiest people look like, right? So first of all, you cannot go too far wrong. You're, you know, on an island in the middle of the Pacific that doesn't look like it's going under anytime soon, right? They eat a lot of coconut and a lot of coconut milk, which I think if I was in a different ecosystem and could justify it, would be my food of choice, right? Anything with coconut milk on it's very good, right? 85% of their food is local. Interesting. Because the problem would be it's expensive, right, to get non-local food. That includes from rural to urban, there's a lot of transference. Yeah, inside. They revalued their strategy for what was worth something and decided that their quality of life was not dependent on GNP or level of consumption. Then instead it was contingent upon how they related to each other. If they had access to food, if they had access to their natural world, yeah, if they had good relations, if they had basic health care and basic education. Interesting set of principles, kind of different, but some basic needs, yeah? And then, you know, I took my 11-year-old son with me. I'm going to just tell you briefly the story on their technology. We go way up this mountain, this four-wheel drive, right? My kid is bouncing off the back of the four-wheel drive, you know, with a bunch of other kids screaming their heads off. We go up there, and we get up there in this village. And this village, there's not a lot of clothing going on, right? Which my son is horrified at. 11-year-old boys do not like to see other 11-year-old boys with basically a penis sheath on, you know, like just like a little eye thing covering up not very much, right? He's like, Mom! I was like, I'll tell you what, honey, that's your problem, not theirs, right? Right, which is the thing you're going to say, you know? So it took him about an hour, no, it took him about a half hour, and he, fully clothed Indian boy, is playing soccer with these Melanesian kids, you know, and they're all like stunning. You know, they have the Melanesian fro going on, perfect teeth, perfect skin, nobody's fat. Their oldest guy just passed on at 114. I'm like, huh, not doing too bad over here in this island without, you know? And they're all eating this local food. The missionaries came to them. They checked them out for a few years, brought them some stuff, kept the clinic, or no, they go down to town for the clinic. But they said, no, that's okay. We'll see you guys later. They sent them away. And then they went back up and returned to their lifestyle. Interesting, huh? And they're really happy. And then they decide to go to town. When they go to town, they put on these sarongs, yeah? You know, wrap, and they go walk down to town, and they go do business and trade their food and their chickens down there. You know, I was laughing because almost everybody had like a Bob Marley sarong. I was like, these are cool people, you know. And then they had technology choice. They had some sanitation, a PVC pipe. They all live in these thatch huts. And they had solar, which they charged a few lights with, and their cell phones. That's their choices. In the big city, these guys had a brewery, right? I think I try their beer. It's okay. Interesting thing about their beer, though, in their brewery, I was like, guess what they do? They just reuse the bottles. They don't recycle them and remake them. Turns out that's highly inefficient, right? Why ship your bottles if you don't, you know? So I was like, this is the same thing as with Hawaii. It's the idea is like, we don't have an exit plan. We're going to have to figure out how to live here, and we don't have the money. Interesting, huh? That's a cyclical economy. That's what I'm trying to say. Very low impact. That's what durability looks like. Our teaching of restorative, you know, healing, you got to make it better. You know, not make it worse, particularly our earth. There are a lot of ways to do things to make it better. I think Will Allen is the king. He is in Milwaukee. Have any of you ever heard of him? Will Allen, Growing Power. He takes like, I'm going to say 2 million tons of food, waste food from the schools, other places, mixes it with garden clippings, adds worms, makes topsoil, grows on brown fields. Not a bad plan, huh? Brilliant. Now, that's the kind of guy who should be like the head of the USDA, yeah? You know, you don't want to be head of the USDA, but yeah. Yeah. Like, that's how you know. So the UN in 2008, according to this book, The Prince, said the answer to the world food crisis is small-scale, family-based farming systems adapting agroecological approaches. Huh. I guess that Monsanto did not write that report. So, what you need over the long haul is not a monoculture, but biodiversity. That is how you're going to survive in the face of climate change, is the more diversity you got. Whether it's from pests or whether it's from wind, yeah. And that requires community engagement. The future will not be brought to you by the giant seed companies, and diversity certainly will not. It's something that pairs, in fact, I believe that biological diversity has to be paired with cultural diversity. You don't want a cultural monocrop. You don't want an America where everybody thinks one way. Yeah. You don't want to buy your way of life at a mall. So that is what the bigger picture looks like. This is my community in 2011 and in 1961. If you're interested, our rice is for sale. It's called Native Harvest. You can get it online. But I show you this picture because we may not have a lot going for us, but we got a heck of a lot of rice. Yeah. And we are some people that realized a long time ago that the economy was not trickling down our way. So we better keep ricing. And that is a good part of the solution. An economy for the seventh generation must be based on the land that is, the ecosystem that is, and adapting who we are to that. It must also be based on a shift in our understanding, which is from a society that is based not on rights as much as on responsibility. And I say that because America is very intent upon our rights. Our rights to bear arms, our rights to free speech, our rights to private property, including at this point the rights of corporations as persons under the law. Right? The opposite of rights is responsibility. And that means you make sure that you can rice. You may have a right to rice, but if they dam your river, you will not be ricing. Or if they genetically engineer the rice and it contaminates you, you don't have the same shot. Yeah. This is my community making maple syrup. When I took this picture, about half those guys were like, "We're going to publish this one. We're going to publish this." I said, "I'm not going to publish it locally." I said, "Good." Like about a third of those guys had active warrants. You know? I'm like, really? Come on, Winona. I said, "I will not put your names." I run a felon-friendly organization, as you may have gathered. It's the way to go. And, you know, that's what the future is going to look like. I don't have all the answers. I just know that the future is made by us. There's not somebody someplace else that's going to do it. Jimisa Wabandaming. Thank you very much for your time.
So we wanted to open it up for a couple of questions. Winona says she has about 15 minutes, so does anyone have any questions?
Great. Thank you, Winona. I think it may be significant to distinguish between the diversity of the geographical description, America as a geographical entity, and the transitory political institution of the United States. And I think it's important for us to make that distinction, because otherwise we confuse them.
Cool. I don't know if I actually understand your
question. Did you have a question? Could you phrase it as a question?
Well, quite often in our culture we misuse, I believe it's a misuse, a cognitive misuse of switching the meaning between America, which is the geographical designation, which encompasses a lot of diversity of people and cultures, and the United States, which is a transitory political institution. And it's cognitively important to try to separate those two.
Okay. You know what I often say that, I guess I'm old enough to say it if I want to, is that I'm far less a patriot to a flag than I am to a land. You know?
Okay, we have another question over here.
Hello, Anona. Why do you think some Americans are so lazy? Like, you look into other countries like Brazil and different countries, people are taking their lives and their own generations into their own hands, but American culture is so blocked or so... They're so, like, not aware of what's going on, how the American government has their foot on the citizens' necks. And only certain people like myself, I'm an activist, and I have several hundred thousand other activists with me, but it's like 350 million Americans that are not really aware of what's going on.
You know, I think we all would probably come up with similar answers. I mean, there's a historic process that occurred. I mean, we basically all got the privilege of, you know, having like about at least 100 slaves in our house. We're living at that level of consumption. Someone is producing everything for us, and we don't do shit. We basically don't. We shop. You know what I'm saying? We buy this from someone else. We are largely people who rely on cash to do anything. And so in creating that lifestyle, we feel entitled to it. We feel that we should have it. We feel that someone should get us goji berries from wherever the hell goji berries come from, right? Like, I don't eat goji berries because I don't want to be the person who eats, like, the last Himalayan goji berry. Do we know? Good. Okay, this is good to know. So can I get the Oregon goji berry thing hooked up then? I heard they're, like, the elixir for life. I don't know. Very good. But you know what I'm saying is that these that is the first thing. And then you've got, you know, I say my reservation, and I don't know if anybody take offense to this, but my community, I say a third of my community is Christian. A third is traditional, like I'm in our traditional religious society, and a third is self-medicated, right? You know what? I think that's America, quite frankly. You know what I'm saying? We're highly self-medicated. We're, you know, if you watch TV at night, I don't know what half those people are taking, but they're all taking it. You know what I'm saying? And or else we're medicated on TV and shopping, and we've become really complacent. And we've dulled our senses, and we're not the people we could be, frankly. We're not conscious and not alive. We're, you know, gardening with a we. Or one of my girlfriends, she's like, I try to get on Facebook sometimes. I'm not good at it. And she says, well, you know, I got Farmville on Facebook. I said, why don't you just farm? You know, what the hell's Farmville on Facebook, you know? Like, go in your garden, you know? But anyway, that's why she's not my friend anymore. No, I should have thought.
Okay. Well, that was a great question and a great answer. I actually have a question. You mentioned political will, and now you also said that, you know, we obviously have the technology, we have the means of creating a sustainable economy, and I've just been reading a little bit about and listening to Van Jones recently, and I feel like for a moment we almost had that person with power to give green jobs to the people who need them and to create that economy that could bring us into a better world. But, you know, he got kicked out of his position of power. So what does that political will look like to you?
I'm someone who, I pretty much work at all levels if I can. But I find that I like to see communities that they don't think can do it, do it. And I think that self-determination and that honesty of making that change, and I see the ripple in, you know, my region in northern Minnesota. We do something, and then the Norwegian farmers want to know how we did that. And so you build at that level. But you have to work at all levels, you know, and you have to work, you know, at combating backwards public policies. And you have to work at, you know, ensuring that there's, you know, adequate access to the grid. And you have to work at that, you know, at all different levels. But I am someone that engages largely in this process of relocalization and having the relocalization have some meaning in terms of quality of life and in terms of actually how you rebuild an economy. So, I don't know. I think I've got right, move for a couple more questions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to ask this guy, man. Where is he? He's saying, what's a cyclical economy look like? I know, chapter 3 is on transportation. I mean, first of all, I didn't get through this book. Did I already mention that? I advise you to look up his stuff, but, you know, first of all, you quit moving around so much, right? I mean, we got a society that's built on this moving around of stuff, which is really, really inefficient. And so you cut a lot of our CO2 and a lot of our need for oil by relocalizing a much larger portion of your economy, right? And then after that, you get more efficient. I mean, if you only work 2 miles from work, you can ride your bike, right? And if you, if you get cars that actually, there's been no motivation in this country to have energy efficiency in our vehicles, right? There's a vehicle he's talking about in here that looks like a Prius, it's the same size, and it uses about a fifth of the power. All possible, all marketable. You basically need a Marshall Plan for an energy economy in this country, which a number of individuals, Van Jones and all, have talked about. If you've got this huge, inefficient energy economy, and you're addicted to oil, you know, the problem with being an addict is that you do a lot of bad stuff and hang out with dealers, you know? So you need to move past that. I mean, we need to move past that if we actually want a chance at hanging around another 500 years, if that. You know, 100 years, you probably got to deal with it then. And, you know, it's not going to get better. I mean, the plan of the oil companies is basically, from what I can ascertain, just keep going as much as they can to milk every last, you know, fossil fuel out, because, and then to move on to something else. But, you know, you'd already saw the lecture. That's not going to pan out. The 20 billion, you know, that 20% of world GDP spent on climate change-related disasters by 2020 would indicate we probably should have a plan before then for food, you know, and for some relocalizing, so. But this guy, you know, if you want geeky answers, he's your guy. Yeah, that's all. Yes? You know, we do the best we can, but, you know, I mean, I don't want to say, you know what I'm saying is I try to look at, like, the lunar thing, you know, I really try to work with that, and then, you know, I pretty much do the best I can, and then the people laugh at me because I travel more. I'm like, well, we're going to be doing it this weekend because I'm home. You know, if it requires me to do the opening ceremony or something like that, which I know is cheap, but that's the reality of sometimes what happens, and then you'll laugh even more at me when I tell you that. I mean, you guys hung out with me for an hour now. You gather probably how eccentric I am and how I'm just kind of like, okay, we'll check that out. So this astrologer came to see us. And he moved into the house next door. We called him Roger the Astrologer. He had like this top knot on top of his head. He was like 65 and from South Dakota and was talking about all this stuff. And it was really funny because I used to set my most, you know, contentious meetings according to what Roger said. And I'd say, like, when is the planets lined up that I can get the, you know, all these guys together? And he would set my meetings for me. And it worked really, really well. So, like, I am all about whatever was working, you know. How do we do what?
It's too big of a question.
One person.
No, I mean, you know, obviously I work with a great collective of people, and when the syrup is running, the sap is running, it is running. You know what I'm saying? And when the rice is ready, the rice is ready. And so I kind of just work with what the Creator gives us, and, you know, and we have a good wild harvested economy too. And so in that, you know, when it's there, it's there. And it doesn't wait for me if I'm not there. You know, I'm like...
Don't complicate yourself, dude.
Let's say you're living in the city, though. I have
can't solve your problem, bro.
Well, it's not my problem.
Okay.
Now, it's our issue. Time is money. That's the linear program you're talking about. You talk about time is money. It's a fundamental error.
Okay, this is the last question, so thanks.
Sorry about that. Masi. Shlahayim, Shlus Tilson, Naginim Perry McDaniel, and I just said good evening, hello and good evening. I'm a direct descendant of the Multnomah Band of Chinook, which all you probably know is the direct descendants of the people who used to occupy this territory from time immemorial. And as such, I'm a member of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Round, where the Multnomah Band of Chinook are today. And as such, it's our tradition to gift people. We potlatch here, too. And so it's in our tradition to gift people when they travel far along to visit in our homeland here. So I wanted to make a gift to my friend Winona. I also just want to say thank you so much for all your inspiration and all your efforts. Because of Winona, us folks out there in Grand Round are starting a permaculture farm of our own. And anybody that's interested and willing and able can come and work on the land out there in Grand Round with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I need to get this. Do you know how to turn this off? Can I just pull this out? I have to leave you now.